Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Adrian Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
2019!
Justin Robert Young.
Yeah, this is the New Year's Day. We're turning over a new leaf. We're totally different people than we were last night.
Yeah, 100%. And our super producer, Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi. Yeah, I got good news, gentlemen. Exciting news. 2019, the future is now. What future, you ask? I don't know. Three awesome realities, all of which everybody's thrilled with. 2019, that's when Akira took place. 2019, that's when Blade Runner took place. 2019, that's when The Running Man took place. Of those three, which one are we closest to right now?
I'm going to live off-world on a colony.
I mean, of the three, almost certainly The Running Man, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Like we are one bold new television initiative away from The Running Man.
Running Man is the one we're shockingly close to.
The new Running Man challenge, same as the old.
Before we get into that, I know I did that intro and something didn't sound right.
Uh-oh.
What was that, Andrew?
It's bothered me for a while. I think we need to add a host to the show.
Hey, we're full up. There's three of us. Everybody knows Weird Things is three hosts.
We're going to add a host to the show.
No, there's three hosts and a super producer extraordinaire, Bryce Castillo.
We can't have a fifth host.
We can't have a fifth member of this cast.
That'd be a lot of people.
Yeah, that'd be weird. Right. Yeah.
It won't be a fifth member. We're going to get rid of one position and add one.
Wait, are you firing me?
They'll still have the same duties.
Andrew,
we're going to change the title.
We've been friends since I was 16. This is a betrayal.
Yeah, all right, look, fine.
What are you doing to me on 2019?
Justin and I will.
Horrifying omen.
Justin and I will fight each other to the death in order to save our one position on the show.
I'll kill him.
I like this better than my idea.
We're back to Journey Quest, huh?
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me like the only way to get a fourth full member would be to fire Bryce, and that just doesn't seem fair to Bryce.
All right, bye, everybody.
But wait, hold on. What if we fired Bryce as super producer extraordinaire and hired hold on, let me have some negotiations. Hey, Bryce, listen.
Hi.
I have a business opportunity. You ever considered being a co-host on a podcast, like a full member of a crew?
I feel like I'm okay. I mean.
Okay, listen. You'd still have to produce, but what if you were the fourth full member full co-host of the Weird Things podcast.
Oh, okay.
And from now on, everyone who went to patreon.com/weirdthings would know that all that money is being divvied up exactly four ways, and you would be making much more than a nickel per episode.
Well, I don't even think the nickel was quite on this one, but okay.
Okay, you weren't even getting a nickel. That's the real betrayal of all this.
Right.
But, but if I could pull this off, would you be into it?
Sure.
All right. All right. Look. Hey, I got a fourth co-host here.
Some hesitation there. Do you have other offers?
No. It's just this is a weird way to propose all of this.
gentlemen, let's all get down on one knee.
Wait, Bryce. What kind of way was this to propose?
A weird way.
Already on brand, co-host. Good job.
Well, thanks for having me. Hi.
Bryce, we would like to upgrade you to full member of the Avengers Justice League the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals.
The ASPCA?
Yes. All of those. Full members.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Also, you're chairman of the board.
Oh, and now I'm. Oh, that's a. Big...
And you're in the Rat Pack.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Cool. And your new name is Bryce Co-host Castillo.
Well, Bryce is already my middle name, so this is going to be a couple of forms.
Yeah,
we're
just getting rid of Anthony. Anthony's right out. Anthony's sorry.
Well, I'm happy to be here. I'm assuming my membership ring, my decoder ring, is in the mail.
You have to ship it to yourself, but yes.
Okay, I'll just go to the warehouse.
By the way, also, we're going to need new cover art. So if you can just go ahead and get on that. Yep.
I think I made some at some point. I think at one point I wanted to redesign all that stuff anyway. Well, I'm glad to be here.
Congratulations.
Yeah. So anyhow, yeah, basically, Bryce, yeah, it's the same amount of work and it's a title change. So.
but also like in all seriousness, quick plug for the Patreon, patreon.com/weirdthings. That money goes to one bucket. Get divvied up exactly four ways. So if you've appreciated Bryce's work or the fact that the rest of us keep showing up, then please be a contributor over at patreon.com/weirdthings.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Gentlemen, I'm going to do – this is like legit. I'm going to do a PSA kind of moment here.
Okay.
Have you looked at the statistics on pedestrian deaths in the U.S.?
Not
well,
recently.
I mean, look, I think we all had a wild New Year's Eve, but not everybody spent it in that kind of scintillating fashion. No, I'm not familiar with these statistics on pedestrian deaths in the United States.
Are they, I mean, long story short, are they good?
Although I will say it is low-key a hell of a read every census to look at, or I don't even think it's census, it's the yearly stats on how Americans have died, because, man, I'm just going to let you know, grain threshers, the real menace in America.
Whoa. Silo fires.
No dive. It is, like, higher than a lot of things that we, like, make laws to stop.
Well, we've had overall, like, traffic and car fatalities have actually been declining. Cars have become much safer, built to handle impacts better, whatever. And so car fatalities have overall been dropping. The biggest trend upwards has been in pedestrian deaths, which have actually, if you go look at, let's say, 2008, there was about, like, you know, between, like, you know, 4,000, like, 2009, there were 4,000 deaths from, you know, pedestrians getting hit. 2017 went up to 6,000.
Now, is that just because we're walking more, or like, is that an indicator that we're being healthier?
There are several causes that are put into there, but if you look at the graph, walking, people tend to be walking more, and that is a contributing factor. There's another factor, though. If you look at when the trend line goes up, and if you take a look at when that is, and you try to figure out, you know, causality and causation, as we all know, there are places to start. Often people go like, they're not, you know, it's not the same. I'm like, no, but it's a place to start investigating, you know.
Yeah.
It's not an excuse to ignore it and say things just happened. You say, oh, these two things may be correlated. How do we test for this?
So I have a graph here. This may not be what you're sending, but this is from the NHTSA showing that fatalities were pretty plateaued between 2009 and 2014. And then 2015 and 2016, they've gone up significantly.
Well, go to the pedestrian category.
Well, and pedestrian is also significantly up over the past, I mean, between 2012 and 2016. Mm-hmm. And the percentage also has steadily increased here. So what is this saying?
To look at the other graph I sent you, and the problem is that often we don't have enough data. We don't have, and that's one of the problems we have to deal with. We don't have a lot of data sometimes about deaths, why people died, or other circumstances around it as far as aggregating this data together. And it's one of the big problems in data sciences and everything else is that you have to, like, gun deaths. Like, I shared a thing with Justin about worldwide. You know, people say, oh, you know, United States, the leader of gun deaths. Well, they only did a search on English-speaking countries. And when you expand that, you find out, like, man, way too many people are dying from guns, you know, and you realize it's a global problem. But the data was biased, you know, from some research we heard because they only did searches for English-language newspapers. And that's other things. Different municipalities record their data differently. But if you show that graph of pedestrian deaths in the United States, go to the right side. Can you think about some big thing that happened around 2008, 2009, and then gradually got bigger and bigger and bigger?
Mobile smartphone usage.
Yeah, iPhones, right? Yeah. Listening to your music while you're bebopping around, listening to your audiobooks.
GPS, texting, distracted driving.
Both people driving and people walking.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, sure, distracted walking, yeah.
So, yeah. And it's And problem is sometimes you'll hear that people blame it more distracted walking because, oh, it's pedestrian deaths. Oh, that's, and you hear people like, oh, people cross the streets on their phones, like, which is a bad idea. But the drivers, I got rear-ended. And it's not because I got rear-ended 2 months ago by a guy who was, guess what?
On
his phone. And it was minor, not a big deal. But this is just a caution to everybody. If you're in a large vehicle, don't pull your effing phone out. Keep it in your pocket. Don't. It's there's the what's the phenomenon where you think you're really good at something but you're not.
The Dunning-Kruger effect, where exactly. It's like you don't even know that you don't know.
I've been with friends who pull out their phones and handle it while they drive, and I'm like, don't do it. Like, no. I'm like, you understand? You don't know that you're bad at it until you get into an accident or you hurt somebody, but then you will attribute it to something else.
Yeah.
2,000 more people die a year now because of this, you know, and that's not counting all the people running into, you know, the smaller accidents. That's just total number of deaths is this. So just learn how to use voice control. Don't pull the phone out.
I mean, look, I made the call. It was my phone or a car, and I picked my phone. So like, it is easier than ever in certain markets. So just say, look, I've made my choice in life. I will not distracted driving because I will distract live.
Well, and there are, like, I know on iOS there's a feature do not disturb while driving, because it can tell when you're in a car, when you're driving, especially if you're using any sort of navigation data, and it'll make it so that your phone doesn't even give you notifications as it tells that you're driving.
My thing on that, Bryce, is that I think if you're responsible enough to turn that off, you're probably responsible to keep your phone in your pocket when you drive.
But this could be one of those things where it's a nudge moment where they make it on by default. Like, you can opt out of it, but just by default, it comes enabled.
Yeah. That's a great point.
Because it's just you make a decision once, right? Like you say, okay, new year, new me. I'm going to take out my phone. In fact, I will encourage anybody who is listening to us right now on an iPhone, go to your settings. It's in settings. You can have like distracted or like do not disturb when driving. It's an automatic thing that just pops up. So basically what you are guarding against in this one moment of clarity is the alert that pops up while you're driving that you look down on and you miss the thing in front of you that causes pain and suffering financially and emotionally for you and those around you.
You know, we had a major setback with self-driving because of one of the car experiments, self-driving car experiments, where they're trying to test these things out there and trying to make sure these things work. And the way they do it is they have the robot drive and they say, well, just to be sure, we're going to have a human supervising. And what happened was you had a human who was so used to it being routine and everything working that they realized that, hey, I'm just going to watch movies on my phone while it's driving. And a pedestrian got killed. And the self-driving industry took a big hit from that. Like, self-driving car hits person. Like, that wasn't the plan. The plan was this human would be intervening and watching the road and say, nope, there's a person. Now we know we need to account for this.
Yeah.
But that's not what happened. You know, and it's frustrating because people blame. And I think they should have been policing the people in the cars. They should have been watching them more to make sure they weren't becoming distracted. But, you know, because of that accident and somebody being distracted while testing this thing, we may have more lives lost because of the delay in self-driving and implementing these features.
And even there was a video earlier this year, or I guess in 2018, of a man, and I don't know if he was using the Tesla autopilot or whether it was another one of these experimental, like Uber or Google's full self-driving stuff. And he was like asleep at the wheel literally asleep,
Tesla.
Yeah. You know, that stuff that's just a bad look for everything, you know?
Yeah. And I use that autopilot mode all the time and I love it. I use it while I drive and pay attention because it's an extra layer of if some car comes at me and I don't see it. Mm-hmm. And when I see people try to use it like that, like it's clearly not what it's meant for. It's like, you know, putting a car in cruise control and taking a nap, you know, on a straight highway. It's horrible. And, you know, and you know, there's people who say that, you know, Tesla should do more to signal people about how you're supposed to use this or not. Maybe the case, but it's an example of an amazing feature when you use it right. When you drive, you see a lot of videos of people who are driving and all of a sudden out of nowhere, some car comes at them and the Tesla swerves and avoids it. It saved, as far as we know, you know, a lot more lives, but that potential for abuse is frustrating.
And in that case, the guy had jerry-rigged the steering wheel because you have to have your hands on the wheel for autopilot to function. And he had jerry-rigged it so that it just had the connectors there and it made it seem like his hands were there.
There was a company selling a fake hand to clamp on.
Oh, my God. That's a one star, good sir, on Amazon. You are a merchant of death.
Now, they got, like, the National Highway Transportation Board, whatever, they got shut down by that. And then they came back and rebranded it as a beverage holder.
Oh, oh God.
Yeah.
Oh, so this is that we are now looking at videos on how you can hack it, you know, basically to do the thing that makes the Tesla believe that your hands are on the wheel. I can certainly understand, you know, look, getting that technology, you know, understanding where it is and making it better. But man, is that stupid?
Yeah, well, that's like, manslaughter at that point. You know, if you do that, you get an that's manslaughter. You know, you're actively disengaging a safety device. You know, and if you kill somebody else, to me, that's manslaughter.
Yeah.
So, anyhow, Happy New Year.
Yeah, there we go. Pedestrian deaths. They're on the rise. But hopefully, you want to know 2019, new year, new country. Let's take that number down a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, let's if you're in a car with somebody and they pull the phone out and they're talking on it or texting or whatever, just like, hey, party foul, dude. Let's
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's be a little safer. All right. So Brian brought up a great point. All these movies that were set in 2019 as being part of the future, all these, you know, content. And 2019 certainly turned out, or as we first day of 2019, probably different than what we expected as children or unborn, Bryce. What are your thoughts? So how did 2019 happen? How does it compare to thought we'd be?
Look, I think by comparing it to those, at least Akira and Blade Runner, we are dumber but cleaner than we thought we would be by 2019. We have a few less crazy gadgets. We have plenty of good gadgets, right? We have a few less of the big, you know, the flying cars of it all and the replicants. But we're making our way. But in general, I feel like we kept things a lot cleaner than we thought we were going to by then, because most of all those stories are all dystopic, you know, totally ink black skies because we've destroyed the environment, trash going all over the place. All of those are parables about how we have lost our moral compass to technology. And while certainly we can have a good discussion, as we often do on this show, about where we are with that, I think in general, it looks like a lot of the things that those stories were illustrating that we lost, we still have, which is good mm-hmm. news.
Not only that from a environmental standpoint, but I believe there are fewer deaths than anyone would expect in any of those dystopian futures. A lot of those stories were written at a time from, you know, 1960s to the 1990s. We saw a horrific uptick in the number of human murders, and that has alleviated itself. I believe we're back down to 1960s and before levels of violence in America. Our taste for the graphic depiction of violence is much, much lower now than it was just 20 years ago, certainly 40 years ago. The kids are having much lower unplanned pregnancies, and in general are getting becoming sexually active later than ever before. And respect for many different walks of life are at unprecedented levels that were completely unimaginable just 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Our air in like the United States, air quality is substantially better. Overall waterway qualities, there's areas for large areas of improvement, but there's more attention to that. But like air quality has dramatically gotten better. Forestry, actually we have, you know, a greater number of trees than we did 30 years ago, 40 years ago when those were first, you know, those stories were put together.
A huge amount. I believe we have the most trees since the mid 1800s, in nearly in 200 years, we got a record for a number of trees.
Yeah. Although I don't know, out here in California, they're starting to act up. I think maybe we should follow through on just cutting them all down.
What, with them burning stuff down? They're just tinder boxes?
I'm not so much of a fan. Maybe we had it going before.
Yeah, and there's, you know, a lot of problematic areas. You know, the developing world, of course, is you try to build your economy as fast as you can, spending money on things like pollution control or things like that you don't do. You know, the plastic waste in the ocean is a problem. It's more has to do with not the consumption of plastics in, you know, the developed world, which is just ridiculous to me that we, you know, ban things like plastic straws when the real problem is recycling systems in places like that that end up dumping waste. It's like 90% of the plastic in the ocean patch, the, you know, great, you know, patch, you know, comes from Asia and Africa because of they're not where we are as far as management of these systems and waste management, et cetera. And I think that my frustration is we pay attention to the wrong thing. You know, we go, yay, we banned this thing, which does effectively nothing. And the attention we put there could have put more effectively on trying to manage those problems. So
you're saying that banning plastic straws is effectively like America doing a juice cleanse. Like, we are definitely feeling some pain, but ultimately it may not exactly have the results that you would have hoped.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think trying to – I've been out in the middle of the Pacific, like way out in the middle of the Pacific, on the bottom of the ocean, if you will, too. And seeing plastic, seeing garbage, that you're like, I'm 100 miles away from anything anywhere, and there is a plastic can or bottle or whatever, and maybe came from a boat. I actually reached my hand out of a submersible cage in the middle of shark-infested waters to pull plastic from the bottom of the ocean because it's like you just don't want that there. And these things can be problematic, but you have to address like the real cause and the real source of these things, not the imaginary ones. You know, and we've talked about this before. You know, we can say, oh, we'll ban plastic bags. When you're in a place like California with lower amounts of water than where those are produced, it's actually probably worse for the environment because if you're using reusables, you got to use detergents and water and stuff to clean it, which takes more water, which then is an impact on the system, et cetera. You know, anyway, I don't want to get into that. But the point is that like there are a lot of things we can do. And I think we need to be smarter in asking, like, is this really going to help or just make us feel like we're helping, but it's kind of BS.
How much of like pollution, and I'm asking because I don't know, but like how much can any individual person bear the weight of environmental disaster versus international companies, you know, creating pollution at, you know, a global scale? Like, if you eat less meat, if everybody ate less meat, is that going to offset, you know, fossil fuel generation or industrialized pollution?
You know, and that's a great question because there are some that argue that it helps. There are other people that argue that when you actually look at land use and how it is versus grazing and protein, it's questionable. I would say one of the things that we could look to is we have a lot of environmental problems because we have pretty good laws in place, but we don't put them into effect. You know, Florida, we have a problem because you have the sugar cane industry uses lots of fertilizers and stuff that then gets flushed out through the canals out into the oceans where it then strips away all the algae, which kills off the fish. And then you get dolphins that eat those fish, but they can't go south because a different dolphin tribe won't let them pass. And you get this big long chain cause and effect because you have a party that is because the state has given them permission to pollute. And it's not a market driven thing. It's politics that you have a lot of these things. And I think paying attention to that.
Yes. By the way, guess who spends ungodly amounts of money subsidizing the careers of politicians in Tallahassee? The sugarcane lobby.
And that's, you know, that's an issue where it's like we've known the issue. And when we say, hey, you know, government's the answer to solve it, it hasn't been for years there because there's
corruption.
Yeah, and I don't and say that like it's insolvable, but asking questions, attention to these things, like, you know, a lot of these problems, we like the knee-jerk ones that make the great headlines, you know, but sometimes these things are more complex, and I think embrace the complexity.
At least we will on this show.
Yeah.
2019, we're all about the complex. We're very complex. Mm-hmm. I mean, hell, we started this show with 3 hosts, now we got 4. Did you see that coming?
So we would say that overall cleaner than we expected, not without a lot of problems, things we need to address and things like our ability to affect our climate, our environment on a large scale are real. You know, the degree to which that can be affected is not something that, you know, we have with certainty, but it is a thing that we need to know. Like, yeah, maybe there's a direction we should be going towards, which is putting less things into the atmosphere than we need to and doing this. How we do it, the way we do it, I think is a matter for debate. But other than that...
I mean, from a tech side, there have been advances in robotics, robotic forms, artificial intelligence, machine learning, where like we don't have replicants today, but we have a lot of the pieces that if, you know, a few different projects coalesced into one thing could look very similar to the idea of a replicant.
I think from the Running Man perspective, we could definitely produce a competition to the death better than they did in the Running Man, right? Like, there's no, like if you were to do the Running Man now on YouTube, like it would look a lot better than the Running Man version that aired in that movie.
Yeah, that was a fun movie. Remember who directed it?
Who did direct it?
Mm-mm. Oh, I know this too because I talked about this movie for like an hour with Cargill on the Junk Food Cinema show, but I forget.
Starsky.
Oh,
Paul
wow.
Michael Glaser. Paul Michael Glaser.
Wow. Very cool.
Man, just such. Go watch the Running Man. The Running Man. Richard Johnson. Legend.
Okay, so we've the flying car we'll say is kind of sort of a reality, not in wide use, but we have.
Oh my God. Wait, all right. I don't know if this is a good thing to sidetrack or if we want to circle back to this, but I feel like we need to discuss, speaking of flying objects, the Gatwick airport.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Oh, I actually don't know anything about this. Yeah. Lead me in.
Hey, Brian, you're the same as everybody else, actually. But Justin, recap.
All right. So I believe it was 2 days before Christmas. There are two major airports that go in and out of London. Heathrow and Gatwick.
'Twas 2 days before Christmas and all through UK. Everybody was tidied up, jolly and gay, waiting for St. Nick and presents that come. When all of a sudden, a trouble. What a bummer. Yeah, almost landed it. Almost. Very close.
This is great. Justin, this was on my notes for last because it is such a great – it is a great where you're like, I guess this is a story because people know what's going on and I'm for me to question this.
Yeah. There's a lot of questions that I have a week afterward and nobody seems to have any answers.
Well, have you heard the – I'll tell you the latest.
Okay. No. I have not heard the latest. So just to set it up. Two major airports that go in and out of London, Gatwick and Heathrow. Heathrow is the more expensive. Gatwick's a little bit further out, but you can get a cheaper flight. So it is very, very, very busy during the holiday season, right? Everybody coming in and coming out. All of a sudden, a drone starts flying in the pathway of where the airplanes land and take off. And so they shut down the airport for a day. In fact, it wound up being, I think, a day and a half or 2.5 days that this drone kept showing up. They didn't know. They didn't want to shoot it down because it might the bullet might land in somebody else's, you know, yard or hit somebody as it came down. But they were effectively crippled by a drone for and maybe we'll see how many. Well, here, 760 flights. We're going to arrive 110,000 passengers. This was a global snarl because of how busy Gatwick is as an international destination. But it just totally screwed up air travel around the globe because somebody had a drone. And by the way, like, we still don't know, at least unless there's an update here that Andrew has for me. Nobody was able to find the people when it was up there. We don't know exactly what kind of drone. We don't know if they were multiple drones that they were going in and out. We don't know why they wanted to do it. But it was – all it took was, at the very least, that people can prove one drone that snarled international travel for multiple days.
Now, before we find out the extra intel that Andrew has, I could see a sideways version of this where it's one person with a laser pointer doing the exact same thing. If somebody's hiding in the bushes and just keep shining a light on every inbound flight, mm-hmm. I could see the exact same thing happening. And then, you know, after a day of harassment, they don't find him, and finally he's stopped, and that stuff lands. So it's like, I don't want to demonize drones specifically, because what the real victim, the real cause is just one person who is, it wants to be an asshat and ruin it for everybody else.
I mean, look, I don't think anybody on this show is putting the blame on the on the technology. Right. I think that it does prove, hey, you should probably have a plan. In the same way that you should probably have the plan for laser pointer guy, there should be a protocol in place to try to figure out, okay, who's doing this? How do we stop it? You know, how do we safeguard all these flights coming in and out? And that's eventually what happened. Eventually this got turned over to the British military, and they employed a Israeli technology to create, they called it like an iron dome or something like that, that basically prevented jammed signals so that the drone, they felt confident that the drone couldn't fly within the certain pathway of the airplane,
but not anymore. Like not like the actual Iron Dome, not like the one.
Oh wait! Oh no!
Not the anti-air missile defense.
You're right. You're right. Iron Dome is the missile tech. This was something dome. Something. Okay. So, I don't know. You can probably Google it, but yeah. It was Israeli tech that eventually got the planes moving again, and I think that's just going to be a thing that will be more of an issue. The more that there are people that want to do it, then we will figure it out. But the fact that we still don't know is, that's the craziest to me. That's the more generating of like, okay, well, there's going to be copycats because somebody just proved how to get away with it.
Well, so this is what, when it first happened, we didn't have any photos of the drone. We had sightings. There were no photos of the drone. And some newspapers ran photos that were just stock photos of a drone. And so you could be led to believe this is a photo of the drone. Was not. It was just a photo of a random drone. Now, apparently there was a sighting. Somebody said, I think I saw a drone. I saw something like this, which then, you know, we just had a week earlier, there was an airplane landed. You saw the nose cone had been crushed by a drone. And so there was awareness of like, yeah, I forget where that happened, but there was like, yeah, this could be very, very problematic. So they did like a perimeter search, and they think they found like part of like a broken drone or something on the runway. Okay, that was part of it. They say that we think we found part of a broken drone on the runway. Not sure when or where, what the story was on that. News goes out, drone sighted around Gatwick, shut down the whole airplane, shut down the airports, Heathrow and Gatwick. They shut this thing down to prevent this. So it shut down Gatwick, right? Big news everywhere, okay? Now they're like trying to find out like what's going on. Is it terrorists, whatever? Into actual terrorist groups and people like this were like, you know, saying like, nope, not us. And story builds and builds, and then they get more sightings. They're about ready to start things up again, and they shut it down because they'll be like, we spotted drones. More people reporting we spotted drones, right? And then they shut it all down again, and then they wait and bring in the tech and all this, and eventually things get going. We don't know what caused the first wave. Second wave.
Can I guess?
Go for it.
Enthusiasts who want to help. These are the equivalents of the folks running out with their deer hunt rifles during the Charles Whitman shooting. Like, I got a drone. I'm going to spot their drone and knock it down.
No, I don't think anybody, any private citizen would have dared doing that at that point.
Okay. All right.
I think I saw a headline that might, I think I see what you're going at here.
Go for it.
Is this possibly all a real estate play?
I don't know about that.
Apparently, well, 5 days ago, Gatwick Airport was sold.
That was in the works way before.
Okay. Because in my head, it's like, we're making this airport look pretty crappy if we.
So, well, what happened is once they're looking, but once this up, the police sent up their drones.
Oh.
And so you had people who were probably spotting police drones and reporting them, and maybe not reporting in the right location or reporting them there. Mm-hmm. It's hard to tell distance on these things. And they might be like, no, ours is over here, not over there. So now you have this second wave. And to your point, Brian, like, yeah, other drones. But in this case, it may have been police drones that kept the thing going. And there may have been some group or some individual may have started this thing. But then the information chaos after the fact.
Wow. So I didn't I was just Googling Gatwick every 6 hours as this was happening. The vast majority of the coverage was about everybody, how far this snarl had gone, right? To every far flung corner of the earth. Somebody was sitting at a hotel or at an airport bar, not knowing when they were going to get home for Christmas. What's fascinating is that idea that even as it was breaking, I was like, yeah, you know, there's some people seem to have like very far away, almost like UFO sighting level photographs of this thing, that there's like a red circle over some dot that could be God knows what, right? But nobody had a shot of the drone. Nobody even knew what kind of drone it could be. And I just assumed in my head that this was being caused by multiple sightings, that there was a point in which it was clear to the naked eye what was happening. I hadn't even processed the idea that, yeah, somebody might have seen a thing once and then hysteria breaks out. And next thing you know, everybody's got a drone. Oh, the drone passed over my house. I had to call.
So it's, who knows? It's Pokemon. It's goblins. It's this. But I think we're going to see more of this.
Wow. Wow. Dude, that's wild. Because that thing was, that was a huge, 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 huge story. So maybe it wasn't drones. It was literally just, people, trying to do their due diligence. And next thing you know, all the information just can't be called correctly.
Yeah,
it could be one started it, you know, and then, you know, that. And then, you know, we had back in August in Venezuela, Maduro, who was apparently attacked by a drone. You know, I mean, it's hard to know anything that comes out of that media there, what the likelihood of it was. But I wouldn't put it past somebody deciding they were going to try to take out the president with a drone.
Well, think about how relatively affordable it would be to get a cluster of let's say 20 drones at around $500 each. So now you're 10 grand into it. You spend 10 grand on software and you're able to do essentially a geese strike to just send a cloud of them into the engines of a plane about to land. I mean, that's horrific to think of how simple that would be.
Yeah, there was back in August too in Syria, the Russian airbase was attacked by a bunch of drones. These were they look like, you know, the these are the winged ones, fixed winged ones. But, you know, apparently a bunch of explosives put on these things and they were launched towards an airbase. And, you know, the fear factor comes in because it's like, well, you know, somebody did a demo of like they put facial recognition on a drone and gave it like, you know, fake gun or whatever. And it's like, oh, this could track you down and do this. It's like, listen. We've had bombs forever, and that allows you a tremendous amount of anonymity, and that's a problem that, you know, not a solved problem, but a problem we deal with. But it's not a new problem of you could remotely kill somebody not even being there. Like, yes, we could do this before, you know. So,
do you think that this eventually leads to, you know, the proliferation of like the jamming tech that apparently the military felt comfortable operating, that maybe it's not whether or not drones will always be dangerous. It'll be whether or not that technology gets cheap enough to where the only place that you're really allowed to fly certain drones are where businesses or the government says you're allowed.
I think that what I'm hoping for is that while we have the scary arms race of this stuff, and part of the problem has been a lot of that tech is like, oh, the military has this tech. If you look at the development, the military is often, there used to be like a 10-year advantage on military over civilian tech. And it was because of the amount of money they could spend and do this. They could do custom chips, custom image sensors, things like this, and pay way more because they never had to go to market. Now that gap is much smaller. I'm hoping that, you know, companies like Apple, you know, and Facebook, to defend their campuses and protect them from harassment, are going to start pouring tons of money into commercial technologies that become available for everybody else. And that'll lead a new race of defensive technologies.
Because I guess really that future would be inevitable unless it's illegal to jam a drone, right? Unless we are like standing up for drone operators' rights and say that you, as a private citizen, like Brian, you let's say at the 7-acre Schwood, tired of these people with their peep and Tom drones watching shooting episodes of The Modern Rogue, I'm gonna make my property and let's even extend it a little further. Impervious to drone, like it'll jam a drone signal. Like now, does that what are the legal questions there? Do you have to keep it to your border? Can you infringe on your neighbor's drone flying abilities?
Because right now you can't shoot down a drone.
Correct.
That's a federal offense.
Well, correct. Although there was somebody. There was that one case in Texas where somebody had like 40 acres and somebody was sending a drone with the intention of harassing the person, and the person shot it down and the court ruled in their favor. So I don't want to say universally, but in general, yes, you're not allowed to shoot things out of the sky. Right. Although it does change things ever so slightly when it comes to like a microwave jamming gun that you just aim and it just, you know, fritzes there, whatever, and forces the thing to land. Then at that point you have a claim. It's like, hey, I'm trying to fly this on my property. It just happens to be at a height that allows me to peek way over your fence line. Do you get to stop them or whatever?
Yeah, I think we're going to see, you know, a lot of that becoming discussed because, you know, airports are going to start wanting to put in systems to defend themselves. And, you know, you could do, remember the project where they showed the thing that could zap mosquitoes, female mosquitoes, out of the air using a laser?
Oh, I don't.
This was actually funded by Bill Gates. And actually, I know the engineer who was head of that project, and basically built a really cool laser that could hit a mosquito with the laser, use the laser to measure the wing beats, because female mosquitoes, which carry malaria, have a faster wing beat or different rate than males. And if it was a female, fry them. And you'd watch these mosquitoes just fall right out of the air. Now, you could build a very simple system that, if it hears the sound of a drone, could locate general area of the sky where it is, then use a camera to spot the drone, identify it, and then use – I've got a laser sitting in my closet that would be powerful enough to drop a drone, which, as you point out, would be illegal. But the technology is really – of course, that laser, too, if I put, you know, your face – into the image recognition system, and there's a problem there, but right. I wonder, we have these technologies if they become a real problem, but will they become a real problem?
I wonder how that parallels like the protecting, say, a plot of property from drones, how that parallels, you know, constructing and protecting a piece of property from street traffic and automobiles, right? You can build a fence, but you can't necessarily shoot someone who you don't like to be there. You can't even, you couldn't, could you necessarily, or and would you want to incapacitate someone?
I mean, I would say
may not even know that they want to be on your property.
I believe that it is legal in the state of Texas to shoot trespassers, and all you need to do is put up a sign that says trespassers will be shot, and then you can shoot people. And so,
sure. But do you want to make a system that goes to that level?
For people or for drones?
I mean, I'm looking at the parallels between these two ideas.
In that regard, if drones have more rights than humans, that does change things interestingly. Where you're not allowed to shoot down a drone, but you are allowed to shoot a human. I don't know.
Well, that might be a thing too. Is can you shoot down a drone on your own property or this? Right. You know, like the idea of. You know, it's going to be, I think we're going to hear more of this because it's not at the point where it's like, granted, a drone going into an aircraft engine is a problem. For the rest of us, it's not a problem yet, but it is one of those things where all of a sudden you know, we'll see. You'll get the period where it just makes more news than it makes problems, but then eventually these things can become problematic. You know, whether you consider a problem or not, you know, drones are used now to smuggle drugs across the border. It's used considerably, you know, using, you know, means.
Oh, yeah. Just one final point on the shooting thing. I think there will always be the question of shooting with a gun because at some point the bullet comes down, you miss.
Yeah.
So, like, that will always be a hard no. However, in the world where we have, you know, a targeted microwave thing that you can just disable and injure a drone without there being a projectile that could fall somewhere else, like, now the question is, what are the corollaries that we can say are, is that like that? Oh, I accidentally, my car was on your property, so you're allowed to destroy it. You're allowed to rip out the engine.
The microwave thing is, it's, if you want to protect a drone from that, it's not hard. That'll stop, you know, the regular one that you can buy, you know, the hobby shop or whatever. But the microwave ones either will, the simpler ones just interfere with the signal and make the drone lose control. But if you have the drone pre-programmed to maintain a flight path, won't do anything. The ones that are designed to scramble electronics, which are much more higher power, and that's military grade, those are harder. But you can actually build systems that can handle that, you know, and then get to the point where a microwave thing really does damage. It's got to be a really high intensity power thing, and it's hard to direct it. You're basically shooting a laser out there.
Sure, but you can also do intercept drones that just go out and squirt silly string. So drone flies.
Oh, no, Brian, I agree. I think that's going to be more like, I think that you're going to want to have, you know, they've some people have been training hawks to do that and all that, but absolutely your point. I think it's going to be other technology like that. Like you're going to have the our drone, which is going to be the one that's going to go capture the other drones and drag it out of the sky.
Right, right.
What do you think the likelihood of the drone manufacturers are to release some sort of tool or API to allow people on a commercial level to build a geofence?
I mean, they're already doing that. DJI has, like, there's a consortium of geofencing and best practices that DJI is working on. I'm sure there are other competing ones. I'm sure everybody, like, they're all on the same page in terms of, hey man, we want more drones and more drones to be sold, and let's get out in front of this and make sure that they auto shut off if the GPS detects that you're trying to fly a drone towards, you know, say a football stadium, or and of course they even have systems that live update where you can fly it at a football stadium
with,
but it updates to know when there's an event going on and when there isn't.
Right. But even on a residential level, if DJI started playing the other side of the field of, like, hey, sign up for our DJI geofence, and if someone tries to fly a drone near your house, they'll get a message that says, hey, don't do that. I'm going to shoot you.
Before we get there, we'll do some kind of version of a do not call registry where it's just like, hey, you can opt in on the national database. You can make your property, as long as it's over, I don't know, let's say 3 acres or whatever, you can opt in to a do not fly registry, and automatically all DJI drones will automatically not be able to pass that geofence without your permission or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess my question is, what is the likelihood that that's something that happens in the next 2 years?
I'd say 100% almost. I think an initiative of that type, whether or not it's successful, I don't know. But I think that they're being very proactive.
Yes, and. But the challenge, like, I have a project I've been funding that's a drone-related. We use PixHawk, which is autonomous drone software, and that's completely open source. We can program and do anything. So you're always going to, if you're a bad actor, which we are not, but you're always going to have the option to say, nope, not going to use it. I'm going to use my own flight controllers and do this and not do that. So I think, yes, we'll have, like, you know, because, like Brian's point, like, I think DJI Phantom, they're going to want to, like, hey, we don't want people to accuse us of using this for this, you know, and, you know, it may get to a point where if it is a problem that it might be, you know, the government might push to say, you've got to use, you know, licensed FCC's got a FAA's got to license the software that you use on this. And if it doesn't have back doors or things like this, then it's illegal. I could see it going that direction.
Weirdly, this whole problem is going to come down to sort of a, I don't know, like it's back to the 1950s. And there used to be a problem where somebody who wanted people to respect his property rights, maybe there were some kids, and the shortest way to get home from school was for them to cut across old McGillicuddy's land. And he wanted to chase them off. So we would come out, shake a gun, shoot it, scare them, say, get off my property. You guys take the long way around. And they don't want to do that. And then eventually, hopefully they, incentives became aligned and they worked it out. I think we're going to see a version of that where, as we have personal shopping drones, either personal property or rented Uber style to deliver me stuff, where it's like, oh man, it's just more expensive. It takes 15 more minutes for my package to get delivered just because McGillicuddy doesn't want me to fly over his airspace. That's the kind of low rent property disputes I think we're going to have about airspace sub 500 meters.
Oh yeah, and let's dive into this for our 2019 episode. Drone delivery. You see it? I can see in rural areas drone delivery. Do you see it in the suburbs as a thing?
Yeah, but it'll be,
I don't know I guess you could deliver to the door, but I don't know if the technology there to do that.
You wouldn't, because there would be safety concerns with kids running up and messing with them. So instead, I think you would have, for example, in our neighborhood, there are no post boxes.
You have a central
instead
mailbox.
It's just one central area. So similarly, there'll just be a pad on top of that. That goes, and then once thrice a day, a person, like all the packages collect there throughout the day. Three times a day, someone goes upstairs, takes them down, and puts them in bins or whatever. I could totally see that, and I could see that this year.
You want to know what I see before that is a super popular, like everyone's got to have it commercial drone. Like, not a hobbyist kind of thing, but like hottest present of 2019's Christmas, like your personal drone, and it'll
the
be
fetch
like
it, or where it's like these businesses are fetch it enabled. If you want your thing, go out to your own backyard on your own pad, 10 by 10 meters. Send off your fetch it, and your fetch it comes back with the pizza, the anything that you might take a 10-minute drive to go get. The fetch it can
I wasn't even thinking necessarily a delivery, although that would certainly factor into that model. Cheap, reliable, and has enough of a battery that, unlike other cheap drones, when you get 5 seconds out of it and then it's like, okay, gotta charge it again.
I don't think it's hard to envision the technology behind a system where you have, and I don't think you'd do the personal one because it's going to be idle 99% of the time, and it's easier like ride sharing to be drone sharing to like have one to do delivery. My issue comes down to the noise factor. Like, they're noisy. They're really, really, it's one of the reasons why flying cars in the current iterations, I don't see. I think there could be other forms of technology we might see it, but like flying cars, it's like, imagine 40 drones all together outside your window right now as your neighbor takes off or lands or that going on. Nobody will want to tolerate that. On top of a building in the middle of downtown where it's further away, et cetera, different. Brian's case, because like I was very dismissive of just suburb drones, but then I thought, well, Brian's slightly more rural suburb, and I could see your example of like, hey, we have this mailbox thing at the end of the street over there, where we could have things dropped off to, could be a drop-off point. And I went back towards like, well, maybe that would be a, you're not going to do it for Justin's place because he's in the middle of Oakland. You're not going to do it here for me because I live in a very, very dense environment. But where you're at, like, yeah, maybe that will be more in rural and, semi-suburb or rural environments.
But I hadn't even really thought of the full rural areas, because there are places where it's a 30-minute drive to get to the grocery store, and yet you're only 4 miles as the crow flies. And so if you're getting stuff delivered, it's like, if I have to go, that's a 90-minute round trip to get a gallon of milk. If I could press a button and pay $20 for a single gallon of milk, but it's here in 20 minutes, like if I'm living in the country, that seems eminently doable.
Yeah, like for you, Brian, to go to your local HEB is a pain in the butt unless you're getting a lot of stuff.
Right.
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 But like, I could see off the roof of that HEB, you know, there's some sales guy that goes around this year and asks for all the little sub developments like, hey, congratulations, you guys are in the radius of where we would like to do a pilot program for drone delivery. Like that I could see. And also, to Andrew's point, that's a loud little intersection that the HEB is on. It only would go further out into open space. Yeah, you'd probably go over some people's houses and maybe they would find it annoying. You might get some complaints there. But I think if you mostly stuck to the road, it wouldn't be any louder than it would be otherwise.
Plus, also, yes, drones are surprisingly loud when they're right in front of you, but I think they're still quieter than a car right in front of you, and I know they're quieter than an air jet engine in front of you. And it is surprising to me, once you get past 100 meters, 200 meters up, they do become fairly quiet. They're pretty much non-existent.
I will say this. From my apartment last night, as we were in bed, as the ball was dropping, I could audibly hear humming of drones outside of my window, assuming that there is, because there's a big drone community around the Lake Merritt, that people will go up and have their little VR goggles to like see out of what the drone is seeing.
It is 2019.
It is. No, it's weird. But you could make out amongst the popping of the fireworks that trademark, like that drone humming.
Sure, but I would say that, do you think that, yes, you could identify it, and it is distinctive, but is it louder than the cars?
I mean, considering we don't have a lot of car traffic, it was something that, like...
It was noticeable.
I am with you in that, last night having heard it, I was like, you want to know what? I could imagine in 10 years that just becoming... You know, when people who live in big cities go out to the country and they're like, oh, wow, it's so quiet. And what you realize is that, no, it's just that you're used to tuning out a lot. You know, there's already a cacophony of sounds that we just, our brains are like, yeah, not useful.
And this is just going to be the latest in a symphony of garbage we want to tune out.
I last night was the first time that I ever thought of it like that, where it's like, that's definitely drones. I can hear drones moving, and God knows where they are. They could be off the roof of my building. They could be off the roof of another building. They could just be a collection of them downtown. But I could hear it, and I was like, you know, I could. It's interesting to me now. I could see myself like tuning it out.
Are we going to see a company that's like Uber did a brilliant job in carving out, so we're going to go to this city here, we're going to fight for the right to be able to do ride sharing, we're going to legally whatever do this, we know there's a need, we're going to do this, and we'll expand outwards. You know, tons of people working on drone delivery, that's for sure. But are we going to see somebody say, hey, we're going to put together kind of like the Uber for this, like, hey, when you're in this area, you pull out your phone, and here are all the things that you can get in 10 minutes.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, but I think you nailed it, Andrew, in that much the way satellite internet and satellite, you know, sat phones or whatever was a rural headed inward solution, so too will this be. Because I think it'll be very expensive. You know, take the Tesla example of take the people who can afford to spend, the wealthy rural are going to say, are you kidding me? I could save 2-hour drive for these sundry elements. 100%. I'm in. Sign me up. And there's going to be fewer restrictions, less red tape for them to go through to set it up. In fact, I would be surprised if somebody's not already knocking on doors, signing up people for this kind of thing at this very moment.
And you could think about, I was thinking about the noise factor and the safety factor. Imagine the drone dirigible.
Sure. Yeah, that would increase the range. It would alter the timeline just a little bit, but it would increase the payload. And that would make total sense.
You wouldn't worry as much about it falling, you know, because it's not.
It would be quieter, right? And that's pretty good. Surprised we're not seeing more of those.
A drone dirigible?
Yeah.
Can you break that out for me? Are we talking about like a mega drone? Like,
well, yeah. Or let's say
I literally don't know what those words mean. So.
Picture a weather balloon. Picture a 10-foot weather balloon.
Okay.
And so now all of a sudden you could carry, instead of 1 pound or 5 pounds, you're able to carry 75 pounds of payload, and it moves slower than a traditional quadcopter, but it's got, you know, maybe a couple of like on the side of the Goodyear blimp. You set it up and it takes, you know, 40 minutes to get however far, but it's got a massive payload, and it's much more efficient. However, then you have it can't operate under certain weather conditions, but basically just a drone blimp in order to get bigger payloads.
Okay.
There's a company working on
sacrificing speed for payload. A quieter product and a more reliable product.
Yeah, and you're fine, because the radius in which you'd want to use a drone often is just, you know, 4 or 5 miles or something, you know. So I think you're fine. Drones are way too fast many times for what you really would need. There's a company coming out with something kind of really cool. The name is ridiculous. Have you heard about the Plimp?
The Plimp?
Oh, Plimp.
That sounds like just a blimp with that's purple.
Yeah,
no, my friends. The Plimp. It's a blimp. It's a blimp meets a plane.
Right on.
Wait a minute. You can ride in it?
Yeah.
2,000 pounds. Wow.
Wow. That's
93 miles an hour.
So what we're looking at is, imagine it's not, it's a got a big air like a helium bag attached to an airframe. And so the idea is that this thing isn't positively buoyant. It sinks, but because it has that helium bag, with a little bit of propeller power, it starts to move upwards. And so the idea is that you're not using so much power to create vertical lift. And this is a great tech that I think may have a lot of potential for delivery and stuff like that, because, you know, you see if a plimp crashes, it's just sort of a slower kind of crash.
Yeah, so it's moving slower. I assume it's more energy efficient as well, because you're not having to go so fast or blast jet engines, so you don't need nearly as much fuel. That's crazy.
I think a plimp is a great idea, because what you're doing is you're combining two really good, you know, lighter than air is great because it takes less energy. You know, you're not spending as much energy to gain altitude. It's crashes slower. I saw a Goodyear blimp crash. I told you about this, right?
I don't remember this. Holy cow.
So back in Florida, I'm driving around and I look up and I see this blimp spiraling and kind of going really, really, really slow to the ground. I'm like, what the hell is going on? And then I see this thing go further down. I get home and I read this blimp crashed in the storage. They took it down a storage and the pilots were fine. And I'm like, this is cool. This isn't that far away. I got my prosumer, my Canon XL1, ran down there, got out of there. I'm like, oh, you're media. Go over here. They pushed me into a media pool. They said, we're going to be letting you in one by one. And they let us into the area where the blimp had just deflated there. And I'm like, man, if all crashes were like this.
where everybody survived and it was just like, oh, everybody, let's all gawk. This is pretty cool. Yeah.
One by one,
to clean up.
Don't spend more than 10 minutes. Come on. Well, let's get everybody in here for their awesome
pretty much what happened. And to clean up, they use scissors. You know? you just cut it up like.
Wow.
That's amazing.
That, to me, is specifically in an area like this where you had a lot of people with daily commutes that are absolutely snarled in traffic over a fairly significant a way to go or distance between going from like San Francisco or Oakland down to the South Bay and Palo Alto and Mountain View and Cupertino. Like, I feel like I'm going to that would be my 2019 lock, is that I'm going to see the plimp rideshare, you know, a couple tech bros going in on a plimp membership for a daily commute.
Yeah, I see that. I really do see as a possibility of that, more so than just straight up quadcopters, because the idea of less noise in theory, it's got wind problems. The adjusting the wind is problematic. It's one of the problems then, because you have a large bag, but, you know, large vessel that's able to be that. But there's a safety factor. It's safer if it's less noisy, you know.
So theoretically, you would be clipping down there at the bottom, like into a...
Yeah.
They would make some sort of passenger module, I guess, that attaches mm-hmm. here.
Man, I can't wait until that's one of the perks of working at Google, is that you can park your plimp.
Well, I mean, we'll do rideshare plimping, you know, because...
Yeah. You have to take the Google plimp.
So here's the Model J. Thank you for your interest in Eagan Airship's Model J, a plummet-proof, ultra-safe aircraft. The revolutionary, expert-designed hybrid airship integrates reliable speed and performance in a unique combination of blimp and plane. 8 passengers or 2,000 pounds in its spacious cabin, which can easily be reconfigured to enable any number of tasks for payload. Mm. This airship can travel fully laden at over 80 miles per hour and offers an aloft cruising time of over 5 hours with a range of 320 miles.
Wild.
With its vertical takeoff and landing, it can lift or touch down just about anywhere. It's not lighter than air, but it uses helium, so it won't just float away, which that's one of the problems the blimps in general is having to let go of, like, the helium. But here's the cost. Ready?
Hmm.
This remarkable hybrid airship can be yours for $1 million a year for 4 years plus overages.
$1 million a year for 4 years.
Right. We anticipate 4 years of building an aircraft production facility, testing the airship, and obtaining an FAA. But yeah, $1 million.
You need to pay them for 4 years as they build it?
Yeah. Yeah. If you want to be an early adopter.
That you're agreeing to have it, spend it for four. Yeah. It's like if you're buying it or leasing it for agreeing to a 4 year lease and paying them $1 million a year.
Sounds like you're prepaying to be in on the first generation.
All right, plimp people, you got to clear this up here. You know, we had our finger ready to buy it.
I was trying to take a look at what we could get to with that kind of distance. As I'm looking up as the crow flies distances for like L.A. to San Francisco or L.A. to Oakland. So it'd be out of that range. You'd have to land, you know, somewhere in Fresno or something, I guess. To
And it's 80 miles an hour. You're not really
saving that much.
This is downtown LA to Bel Air, rush hour.
Yeah, yeah. No, I definitely could see it going from San Francisco to Palo Alto. Like that. That I think is something that if you were able to do that, like at 90 miles an hour, like with only on roads, that's really not that bad of a drive. If it's in traffic, you want to shoot yourself.
Is that the model for this? Is instead they should say we're going to pick a route like that. We're going to pick, you know, some central place in San Francisco to there and say we're going to start a service later next year.
I mean, like, if you could run it. What I'm trying to do is figure out exactly what our seed money, our ask is, and which high rise we are trying to attract as our plimp takeoff. And then we just land them right in the middle of the South Bay and then they can get picked up by all their campus buses.
And I think we even did talk sometime last year about someone trying to do the same thing.
Yeah, it was going
to
be like a hexacopter single-person pod.
Uber, yeah.
The Uber, drone bus.
Uber had a thing like that. Although I think that might have been the colonic regime. Mm. I don't know whether or not that's in the...
No, that's the new... That's the, I mean, that's still...
Was that still a thing?
Yeah, because, I mean, that's been – I think Colada was really the self-driving, and they've been actually spending less on that. And I think because now they're looking at, like, other areas of transportation. So Uber Air is post-Colada. So I want to see all these things. And I don't – you know, I'm rarely dismissive of something outright. I'm like, oh, that's stupid. That'll never work because it's like, hey, you know, surprise me. But Uber Air sounds like it's electric helicopters, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. I guess that's the thing, is like really what's the breakthrough that where, I mean, I guess it's battery tech, that as battery tech gets cheaper and cheaper.
Self-driving too. No pilot.
Sure. Although, like, that's not as crazy, right? You know, I feel like air travel has always been leaps and bounds beyond in autopilot scenarios, right?
Yeah, but nobody gets on a commercial airplane yet with no pilot.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. I love how they don't show the prices.
Let me do one more kind of cool 2019 spin to see. This is something we talked about the week before. Brian, you've been following what's been going on in Boca Chica, Texas.
SpaceX. No, I have not, man. Bring me the latest in my own backyard. You'd think I'd be all caught up on this.
Should be. Well, eagle-eyed viewers, spotters, have been driving by. Boca Chica is this facility they have in South Texas where they plan to be, you know, basically the launch facility they want to use, their own privately owned launch facility. And people have spotted something kind of interesting. If we go to the Reddit, if you want, I like going to Reddit, the SpaceX Reddit, and there's a lot of little links there. Brian, care to describe what you're looking at?
Oh, these are the photos of the of formerly BFR, now Spaceship. Jesus, would you guys quit changing the name of the freaking thing? Why? I don't understand the value of changing the name 25 times, but whatever. It's big. It's very, very big. Looks like a spaceship.
This is the Hopper. This is the Hopper they're planning to test it. They're going to use 3 Raptor engines in this thing, and there was a lot of speculation before that, oh, it's a water tower, they're not building this, and like, yeah, nope, they're building the Hopper, and we're watching this thing be assembled right now with
the specifically goal, the Hopper is basically just designed to test its ability to land vertically and all that stuff, to take off and land vertically.
Test the engines vertical, you know, take off and land. It's going to be, it's like a third, it's like half scale or 2/3 scale of the actual Starship is going to be. And Elon Musk has said they want to test this in March or April.
Wow. You think that'll be a publicly a spectacle, or do you think they'll just quietly do it and then release video?
It'll be on the IG.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, certainly, but I mean, if it's in my backyard, that might be worth a trip.
Yeah, it'll be hard. I don't know if they'll announce specifically to when they're going to do it, but I think that there will be probably a lot of people starting to watch, waiting to see this thing happen. So it's kind of cool. So you see this. This looks sort of rougher than, you know, the finished product. This is the goal here, is just to test the engines, the capability. It's the first time they're using methane, and to test it as the lifting capabilities. But, man, if we're not going to see a prototype taking off and landing first half of this year is a real possibility.
So. Crazy.
That's dope. Okie dokie. Any last minute predictions for 2019?
Yes. Weird things will be even better.
Cool.
Hot take. Hey man, you guys got any picks?
I do.
All right, let's go.
Last night, I watched, went to my Apple TV, fired up Netflix, looking for something to watch to ring in the new year. Clicked on the new Black Mirror Choose Your Own Adventure Bandersnatch. And was told I can't watch it.
You cannot do it. They show you a 2-minute video that says, hey, no. And then, did this happen to you where they send you an email immediately after saying, hey, you know that thing you tried to do? You can't do that on the Apple TV.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, a lot of the Netflix stuff goes to my spam at this point, but I have no doubt that I did. We then plugged in my wife's laptop and actually watched it. It is interesting. I inherently think that kind of storytelling, and I don't mean interactive necessarily or choose your own adventure necessarily, but video choose your own adventure is kind of inherently
awful.
Flawed. It's just number one, it puts so much weight on which decisions you are trying to allow people to make. And look, in classic Black Mirror fashion, the movie is about the idea of a choose your own adventure and the decisions that you do and don't give the people to do it. At the end of the day, I kind of would have just preferred 3 versions of the movie that I could watch. Like, I think maybe
The ending of the movie Clue, where it's like, that might be how it happened. It could have gone like this.
But effectively, that's what happens at the end, is you basically, like, you finish your line of the story, and then it takes you back to other points that would have made substantial changes to your narrative, and they just tell you, oh, this time pick the thing. or this time pick the other thing.
And it's all a little inelegant, especially because it has game overs basically. And
yes.
In a lot of cases, it's incredibly abrupt. Of just like, ooh, you want to go back? And it's like some cases like, oh, you destroyed a thing that probably can't move the story forward. But it's frustrating because it's an all right idea, but I don't think that they set good expectations with it.
You know what would have been more Black Mirror-y? Whether they had the technology to do it or not, whether they sort of lied and made it a nonsense engine. Imagine having to turn on a webcam and then there's a brief orientation where it says smile, frown, squint, you know, do this stuff. And then you got enough proof that it establishes, okay, it's definitely tracking my emotions. And then it says, all right, we're going to watch you watch this. And we're going to make some decisions as we go. And you don't have to think or say or do nothing. We're just going to change the story. We're going to make selections based on what we see from you.
Like, so number one, that idea is, I think, baked into the Bandersnatch story in where it goes. Because in very Black Mirror kind of fashion, A, you're watching a Black Mirror story, which if you enjoy Black Mirror, it usually means that horrifying things happen to characters that you either like or don't like, right? Mm-hmm. I enjoy watching it because I would probably not make these decisions if I were a storyteller. That it often veers into bleak, hopelessness, violent places that I don't want to have happen with somebody that I have now learned to like. And yet it put me in the position of being like, okay, no, am I doing the story that I want, or am I doing a Black Mirror story? And now they keep trying to push me into these decisions that I kind of don't want to make. I want everybody to start communicating more and just get through this problem instead of it devolving into something horrifying, which of course is the brand of Black Mirror. I'd be a bad Black Mirror author. And I felt that that's what I was doing as I kept picking the safer choices for all of my decision making.
Well, and that makes it tough because you're right. Black Mirror, almost every episode of Black Mirror has a like horrifying bad ending, an ending of despair. And the way Bandersnatch is sort of structured is much like an FMV game where and you want to win, right? You get all of this emotional this emotional connection to the main character, but you're only given the options to essentially torture this guy, and any the deviations from that, you know, don't get you to the end of the story. And that's a very tough mismatch. And that in the little bit of that of it that I watched, because I only got, I guess, one of the endings, isn't addressed at all. Like outside of the fact that there is some relationship between the viewer and the main character, the viewer clearly has its own limitations, and that's not even a factor into this. So it is very much kind of what you were saying, Justin. Like, am I doing what they want, or what is my amount?
Or do I want to win?
Right.
Yeah. Here's the problem in interactive fiction formats like this, and I say this as a guy that's got a table filled with about 100 choose-your-own-adventure books and gameplay books and all this, who's fascinated by this and who has no easy answers, but problems. And that is, there's a point at which a really good interactive story, it just becomes a game. And you have to say, what's the difference between a game and interactive fiction? And there are no rules, but you know, when you start making those choices, or how much choice you put in there as an author is sort of, you know, what you have to do. And I think that's what we talked about before the show. Like, I haven't watched this yet, and I literally am booting up right now. I built my own interactive fiction creation platform because I wanted to, you know, make it easier to try to write hypertext stuff and all this. And I didn't think Twine or what other things they do would serve my purposes. But I think I'm glad they did it. The problem is you don't get a lot of opportunities to experiment and do this. And you know, the fact that when this thing launched, it didn't work on Chrome. But then you get into the storytelling problem of, left hand. Do I go left or do I go right? Well, those those are great video game choices, but for storytelling, I don't know the difference between the two. And really bad choose your own adventure stories are like that. I went left, I went right. It's an arbitrary, it's a flip a coin. What difference does it make?
And that I think is ultimately the problem, is that there's a lot of those where it's like, I trust Black Mirror. I trust Black Mirror to be like, okay, I'll bet you I'll like left as much as right, but I don't know. And it made me anxious to be like, oh wait, if I choose this 80s song instead of this 80s song to play on his Walkman, like, does that mean that I'm fundamentally different than I was otherwise? Because that kind of seems stupid. I don't know what the other band is. I know who the Thompson Twins are. Stop bothering me, Bandersnatch. Like, just show me this movie.
Well, and it kind of takes a long time too, right? In this sort of film format, you have to. It's not like a visual novel, which is what you would base this sort of structure on, where you can quickly skip through a lot of text and just be choice focused as you explore your way through it again. You have to sit through and rewatch the movie, and that can be really frustrating.
Wait
if it's
a minute,
not...
Did it not kick you back to just watch other stuff like at the end after the credits rolled?
Well, I know when we got to a game over, it would let us go back to different points to start over. But when we got to the end of the credits, it was like, hey, you're done. You saw like this like an actual full ending with the whole credits thing, and we didn't sit through the credits, and it didn't. We took the offer to take us back, it went to a choice that we had already tried again and failed at, and so it didn't offer to take us back far enough.
So yeah, what happened for me is once I got to the end and it like credits roll, then at that point there was just it kept bringing us back to a point in the story with the note on what you should do this time. And then you would start it, and it would basically kick us back into the story.
Oh, it told you what to do.
Yeah.
Oh, I know that there are multiple full endings, and so I wonder if the one that we got, because this ending was also self-referential, whether we just ended up on a true ending, and they considered that to complete the circle, and we just slept into that.
I understood that the mark of the ending is his game being reviewed. And I mm-hmm. saw multiple versions of that.
So right, no spoilers.
Yeah.
The
thing I saw had an epilogue to that whole idea, which felt very much like an ending. But then it doesn't make me want to go back and explore this other stuff, especially if that's like the right one, quote unquote.
Can I show you something real quick? This was the tool that I made for writing interactive fiction.
Okay.
I wanted to write. So what I did is I created a system where you can start a story, right? And if you create add a path, you get a path. You click on there, you write your scene. Let me go into one where I had like stuff written. If like this is like an actual scene where you have, you know, more text written, you go in there, you get to the bottom, you can add these things, go to the next level. I wanted to create something that was just super easy to jump around into and create multiple paths.
Okay.
Or create standalone paths. And then you can just jump in there and go back. Because it's so hard to write these things. My point is, these things are so hard to write. Mm-hmm. I thought, why don't I make a tool that allows you to just sort of jump around, make it quicker. You can visualize it, go in and out of it.
Yeah.
And then I also like this thing will export into all sorts of formats. If I want to preview this, I can go into those and just you go into a preview version, it automatically does an HTML version of it. It'll do an ebook version of it. It'll do all that.
Sure.
So print book.
Yeah.
So.
And I know you mentioned Twine earlier, which is a hypertext mm-hmm. sort of choose your own adventure thing. What was it about Twine that?
I think it's not. Some of these things I would argue they're created by programmers who want to do interactive fiction, who aren't working from the writer or the creative side of their mind, and they feel like their programming tools are just Twine is this. It's to me, the interface was just not a good interface to work in. It wasn't a flow. This you can write and you can take here. You can take a story, paste it into here, add an insertion point, say, I'm going to add a new point here, go off into this. It allows you to write a lot more like you're writing in Scrivener or word processor without having to do any kind of coding or anything that feels like whatever. you know, I just took like, what were all the problems I had with that? And so I've had a couple, you know, one other friend who's spent a lot of time in it, but I just kind of said, all right, this has been too much of an obsession for now. I'm going to do something else.
Okay. Cool.
It works. It's functional, but Brian? I don't like Twine. Twine to me just was not a Twine stories became go left, go right. They didn't feel very, you know, it felt more like game development than story development. Hmm.
Hey man, my pick is I'm back again on the Dark Tower. I'm going for like my sixth lap of it because my brother gave Penny all seven books and she's at the age of 14. So I wanted to try to get her into the idea of it by reading just the beginning of the first book, and then suddenly here I am halfway through book two, Drawing of the Three, doing my best impression of the greatest audiobook ever, reader ever, Frank Muller, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Are you on the first book? Like,
No, we're midway through the second book, Drawing of the Three, yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
I have a pick, and it was the champion of the holiday break, and that was Nailed It Holiday. The holiday edition, holiday season of the Netflix cooking show Nailed It. Man, is it fun. And it's so light and breezy and everyone can enjoy it. And, you know, I've talked about Nailed It before, but it really works because everyone is in on the joke that these home cooks are not good at, you know, making cakes and stuff. So when it comes out bad, no one's upset that it comes out bad because everyone knows that the expectation is super, super low. So I think more of that is really great. And I was surprised at how many, I think there's like, they did like seven episodes of this holiday season. So it was more than I expected even. But
oh, wow.
Yeah.
I guess it's just cheap to produce. If they have the set, they might as well bang out more, right?
Yeah, right. So Nailed It Holiday. That's on Netflix.
My pick, and there are sometimes you make recommendations and you say, hey, I love this. If you don't love this, I'm not going to blame you. You know, we won't come to words. There'll be no fisticuffs. If you say, it sucked, I didn't like it, I won't be like, no, you're wrong. Some things will be like, no, you're just flat out wrong. And the objectivist in me comes to the surface. But this is not one of those. This is one of those, I had fun. I really dug it. I've seen it twice now. And Aquaman.
Yes!
It's Aquaman. it's a movie that knows what it is. And as Justin pointed out, there's a point at which an octopus plays the drums.
That's right. I forgot about
and
that.
You're like, I'm on board. I get what this is. You know, you get a fight between two people and you get their stats. And if you read the stats, it's funny. And you know, they were having fun with this movie. Mm-hmm. It's not a movie that takes itself too seriously. It wants to be likable and work on what they have. And I thought it did a pretty good job of that and enjoyed it. And the visuals I thought were amazing. Really relived it. The soundtrack I thought was fantastic. If you don't like it, I don't blame you. It's like, I know people who love Batman and Robin. I go, it's a horrible movie. They go, we know, but we love it. I'm like, okay, I get what you're saying. I wanted a Batman movie that I could learn from and become Batman from. You just wanted to be entertained. Fine.
Mm. Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah. It's a
but big, Aquaman is what it is.
It's a big dumb action movie. I went and saw it with my parents over the holidays and you know, it's, I will say I do enjoy that it had a plot, which I feel like a lot of other superhero movies that I see don't always have an entire one of those. But I enjoyed it. I was about halfway through it when I was like, oh, this is just National Treasure, but in the water. And that totally works.
Yeah, I used to describe, and I won't say what movie it is, but it was maybe magic themed. I said it's like a dumber National Treasure, which is saying a lot. And this is... This is a big, it's like National Treasure meets Avatar meets I don't know what. And I would say that in between this and Wonder Woman, I mean, the further DC gets away from And again, and I would say, oh yeah, people, it was too dark. People don't like it. Like, yeah, Dark Knight and Dark Knight Rises were too dark. Nobody saw them, but somehow they made $1 billion each, you know? Mm-hmm. No, they were great movies. Those movies were great. We haven't had great movies in DC since, though, but I would say Wonder Woman's been really good and Aquaman's been really fun. And if DC keeps doing this, I'll be happy.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Brian, you see it yet?
I did. but
the golden rule?
Yeah. Let's what we could talk more about it in after things.
Okay. Cool. It's, you know, I shouldn't say it.
Oh no. Andrew, we beseech you, please.
Say it. Maybe our other host could say it.
Oh, well, I mean, if you, is that okay? Is that a, is that, do I have,
I don't know. Is it? Is it?
I don't know.
Equal power, man.
I guess I'll try it out. Hey guys, it's been weird.
Woo! He did it. He did the thing.
Great, Bryce. Any other things you want to take from me now?
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.